Hi, I'm Paul Listick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain. You know, there is probably nothing more important to a president than the legacy that they leave, how history sees them. And a lot of things shape that, of course, but one of the pieces that certainly helps shape a presidential legacy, which is under his, maybe her, control, is the library, the presidential library. And we see them go up, we see them built, we've gone through the whole set of dynamics tied to the location and decisions made to the Obama presidential library. But the bottom line is there is so much politics involved in these decisions and the portrayal of presidents in libraries that I think it's time to go behind the curtain a little bit and get a good look at what's really going on. Joining me is Anthony Clark. He is a former congressional rep. He is a presidential library expert. This man knows what he's talking about, and what a great time to chat again, because it is time to talk about presidential libraries with presidential library expert Anthony Clark. Anthony, welcome back to chatting with me.
Great to be back, Paul.
So let me start in a general way. Obviously, we're going to focus on the future as the Obama Library, gets underway and, opens in a period of years. But in general, one of the things you write about in your book, and I should emphasize the title of your book, it's called The Last Campaign, and that may say it all. The Last Campaign, How Presidents Rewrite History, Run for Posterity, and Enshrine Their Legacies. Talk to me about just how honest and truthful presidential libraries are in general.
The short answer is not much. The slightly longer answer is that presidents and their families and their most important financial supporters are the ones who decide what gets told in the quote-unquote history in the presidential libraries. And so those folks are not going to be ready and willing and able to come out with all the scandals, all the outrages, all the so-called problems and say, yes, he or she did all of them, and they were as bad as you think they were. So on the one hand, you can understand why the initial exhibits at presidential libraries are very almost fact-free, right? For example, the Reagan Library opened, and for 25 years, they didn't even mention the phrase Iran-Contra. There was no exhibit about it at all.
And that would have been his decision, right?
Family? Family decision, yes. In fact, the foundation that the president creates is geared towards one thing, raising as much money as possible in order to build as important, as long-lasting, and as impressive a facility as possible. And so you're not going to get that kind of donations from people who are inclined to criticize the president.
That makes sense. There are going to be supporters who are going to donate. Let me see if I can divide these libraries, and maybe I can. You'll tell me. In a living or dead distinction, but I don't mean living or dead today because almost all of them are gone, some are around, but I mean libraries like Lincoln's, I mean the ones that got built and created well after, I think even FDR's library was done well after his death, right? Because I don't know when presidential libraries first started to actually happen, but is that a fair line to draw, libraries that living presidents play a role in and those where they never played a role?
Well, it depends. For example, if John F. Kennedy really had almost no role except him wanting his library in the Boston area. He didn't get the location that he had chosen at Harvard. It got moved because of community opposition. But the manner in which he died changed the plans from the John F. Kennedy Library to the John F. Kennedy Memorial Library. And the initial plans that were started in December of 1963 had the library not only being the place for his records and the place for his museum, but it was initially going to be the national monument and memorial to President Kennedy. And so at that point, there was even a greater overwhelming feeling that we had to create a grand memorial to not only his life, but the manner in which he died. So it really does, that's a great question to ask about whether presidents have a role to play. By the way, FDR built his library near the end of his second term, not knowing at the time that he would run for a third and eventually a fourth term. And so his library is the only presidential library to have a sitting president work in it.
Oh, wow. That I did not know. Well, of course I didn't know that. You know everything.
Yeah.
With regard to people like Lincoln, right? The Lincoln Library in Springfield, Illinois, obviously built, a century after Lincoln's even around, more than that. So I guess that's what I had in mind, a library that gets built well after a president's death. Are we still influenced by the politics?
Well, it's funny. We're not influenced by the politics of the time. We're influenced by the politics at the time it was built. For example, you don't have a lot of family members around from the Lincoln family saying, we want it put into the museum that this happened this way. But you do have people saying, look, we're going to spend an awful lot of money in the state of Illinois to create a museum. We want to make sure people come to it. We want to make sure it's utilized. And so there's pressure to maybe make it more like one of the criticisms of the Lincoln Library when it first opened was that it was the Disney version of Lincoln. There were holograms and there were animatronics, and it was very, very consumer friendly. It wasn't seen necessarily as, 150 years after his death, can it be more sober? Can it be more academic? It was seen as very commercial.
Wow. Okay. And that makes sense. It's sort of today, right? People go there, but to study. And by the way, the main purpose for a library, we should talk about that. I mean, it is meant to be a repository for documents, but it is, if somebody is going to become a scholar and study the work of a past president, of George Bush, of one day Barack Obama, this is where you want to go.
Yes. Although, remember in the 50s and 60s, when people started talking about space travel, they thought, well, it's going to take us so long to get to other planets, we have to have generational spaceships, right? So people would give birth to their kids, and their kids would give birth, and then they'd eventually make it to other stars. That's kind of how we have to think about presidential libraries, because the library opens about 4 years after the president leaves office, but the records won't be open for 100 years.
And what is the point of waiting 100 years to look at the records of President Obama when we want to understand now
exactly
all that went on in his 8 years?
And that's the shame about it. It's not as if Congress passed a law that said because of national security concerns or privacy concerns or, matters of taste, we need to keep them locked away. The law says that for the first 5 years after a president leaves office, you can't release anything. That gives the National Archives time to start preparing the documents, start reviewing them for release. And then it says that the president can add an additional 7 years to that restriction. So let's think of it as 12 years. So theoretically, the most documents can be available after 12 years, so 2029 for President Obama. But
wow. Yeah.
The problem is that the National Archives doesn't employ enough archivists to review the documents to get them out quickly. They do employ a heck of a lot of people to run the public commercialized or Disneyfied versions. Like, they have a lot of exhibit specialists and curators and museum technicians and public affairs specialists and communication specialists and education specialists. There's a lot of money, apparently, in the federal budget to promote the legacy, but not a lot of money for archivists to review those records to make sure we're not releasing things prematurely.
And what role does a president play? Let's take a look at Obama for a moment, because, for example, there was all this news about letters being found that had been written by Barack H. Obama Sr., his father. And, obviously there was a drifting in that relationship. But apparently Obama Sr. had written letters that are very informative of their relationship and what he thought. And as I understand it, they were, the president was given the opportunity to look at them and whatever, and didn't and hasn't, and says one day he will. But my point is, I would think if I'm going to study Barack Obama, I want to make sure I see the letters from his father. I'm going to learn a lot from that. Does the president play a role in saying those will never be made available, or does he not really have that control?
Well, in the aftermath of Watergate, the law was changed to make presidential records public property. Until Richard Nixon, they were the personal property of the president, and the president could decide, I'm going to lock away these records for X number of years. I'm going to release these records right away. So theoretically, on paper, it seems like, yes, the president is no longer involved. However, like I said before, the president can extend that five-year restriction on some records to 12 years, number one. And then number two, after the president leaves office, which means they no longer have governmental authority, they no longer have any power, they're still allowed to restrict access to records. So, for example, if you wanted to make a request to the Clinton Library right now to certain records, not only can the current president, Barack Obama, delay access to those records, but the request also has to go to the former president for his approval or her approval as well.
And if Bill Clinton were not around, would it be a family? In other words, Hillary could make that decision, or it's just about the living the president as long as they're alive?
Well, here's how we're getting into some problems with the law, because it's one thing to say that a former president once had the power of the presidency, so by extension, they keep that executive privilege in their retirement. I don't necessarily subscribe to that theory, but it's a theory that's been proposed. But now we get into what happens when the president dies. Does their spouse then pick up their executive privilege to assert authority over the records? What about
Because like I would think Nancy Reagan, until her death, probably exerted all sorts of rules and requirements that would have impacted her husband's image if she had the control and power to do so, at least regarding the library.
Well, I can tell you this: when John Roberts was being examined for his job on the Supreme Court, the many records about his service in Reagan's Justice Department mysteriously disappeared temporarily until after his confirmation process, and then they were found.
Well, isn't that interesting?
Yes.
I would assume something diabolical may have been going on.
Well, what had happened was that people who were vetting the candidate, the nominee for the position in the Bush administration, did go to the Reagan Library and did look at those records, and the library has never given a satisfactory answer as to why they were not made available to the rest of the journalism community or the public until after his confirmation was secure.
Now, let me just follow up on that one Barack Obama's father's letters thing, because it raises the question for me, well, what is a record? I mean, I understand that anything the president put his hand on during the course of his administration is a record. A letter or a series of letters from his father, that as I've just described, are those records?
They're not presidential records, and they wouldn't fall under the law that governs presidential libraries. However, almost every presidential library has a wide variety of other records that have been accepted either through donation or through deed of gift, you know, once somebody passes away. For example, if you want to study Laura Ingalls Wilder, who is the author of the Little House on the Prairie series, right, you have to go to the Herbert Hoover Library in West Branch, Iowa, that has her papers.
And because her estate left them there? Why did that happen?
Exactly, yes, because of the connection to the Midwest and Iowa. Many of Ernest Hemingway's papers are kept at the John F. Kennedy Library.
Interesting.
And so once it gets placed in the library, the donor can still create restrictions over it. The donor can give it to a library, but say, like, for example, President Johnson restricted access to his taped telephone conversations until 50 years after his death. But after he died, about two decades after he died, the National Archives was able to convince Mrs. Johnson, Lady Bird Johnson, to release that hold, and now we have a treasure trove of hundreds and hundreds of hours of recorded tapes from the Johnson Library.
So if Hemingway's papers are left at a library, whatever, I mean, couldn't the library – I mean, what if the library doesn't want – what if when I die, I say I want to leave all my papers – I don't have any – but I want to leave my papers to the Barack Obama Library. I mean, I don't understand how – does the library then decide, well, we don't want them?
Yes. I mean, they could make a – I think there's often a stretch to connect the donor to the receiving organization. I think it wouldn't be a stretch for a prominent Chicago journalist to give his or her papers to the Barack Obama Library, but maybe it would be more of a stretch to, if you said, well, I want to give it to the Clinton Library or to the Carter Library in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. But I think there's a concern about how much federal money is being spent on preserving those records and preparing those records once they're donated.
Yeah, let's talk about scandal a little bit. So if I were to go to the Nixon Library, how much Watergate stuff do I see? And would it be different now that he's been gone for a while, as opposed to back when the library was built? Do these things change? Or Bill Clinton and his scandal, he's still around. And yet, of course, we have the whole Monica Lewinsky thing. So it is a part of history, as you opened up by saying we didn't see Iran-Contra in the Reagan Library. How do the scandals get addressed?
I think it gets addressed a couple of ways. Number one, with Nixon, up until 2011, if you went to the Nixon Library, you would have learned from the Watergate exhibit that he personally wrote that Watergate was a Democratic plot to get him out of the presidency and make the Democratic Speaker of the House, Carl Albert, Speaker. Now, there wasn't anything that was factually accurate in that initial exhibit. When the National Archives took over the library, they were able to the director, Tim Naftali, was able to insist on his first job was to remove the Watergate exhibit and replace it. But that happens rarely. I think that it was 25 years after the library opened, almost, I think it was 21 years, when the Reagan Library finally put in a small kind of begrudging exhibit mentioning Iran-Contra. It's nowhere near as thorough or accurate as historians would want it to be. I think part of it is the president passed away. Maybe the president's most vocal wealthy supporters had either passed away or had no longer been so insistent, about protecting the line. Yeah. I mean, heck, Monica Lewinsky was named by name in the original exhibit that still exists at the Clinton Library when it opened in 2004. But there's one way to handle it, which is ignore it. The other way is to include it and get credit for including it, but for spinning it. So, for example, the exhibit where Monica Lewinsky is mentioned, it does say that the president made a mistake, and it does say the president apologized. But the exhibit isn't titled "The Personal Failings of the President" or "Why Character Matters in Our Leaders." It's "The Republican Fight for Power," and it casts the Lewinsky scandal with the impeachment scandal, and it says this was the Republicans trying to do, with their impeachment what they couldn't
do.
The
whole right-wing conspiracy thing.
Exactly. So, I mean, I can tell you this. Yes, you get credit for mentioning a scandal. And yes, you get credit taken away for spinning it.
And I guess so much of this does make sense. I mean, look, if I'm Mitch McConnell and I'm creating Barack Obama's library, I'm going to talk about how the economy has failed and put a spin on it that makes everything look terrible. If I'm Barack Obama making my library, I'm going to show all the growth we've had every month since I've been president. I don't know. I mean, it is spin, Anthony, but I mean, it just sounds like it's the political realities of things that any fact can be looked at differently, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat.
I'm going to give you one example of the person that in this particular instance, in terms of what goes into a presidential library, I have the most admiration for. When Gerald Ford was meeting with his top advisors about renovating the Ford Museum in Grand Rapids for the first time, it was back in the 90s, they found out that they were able to get the actual staircase from the roof of the Saigon Embassy, the U.S. Embassy in Saigon, mm-hmm. that was so iconic with the photographs and the film of the people fleeing the embassy.
Sure, right.
Now, Henry Kissinger at that meeting said, but Mr. President, we can't possibly have this. It's a symbol of American defeat. It would be a negative mark on your presidency. You can't do it. And after a series of arguments, Ford uncharacteristically slammed his hand on the table and said, but Henry, it's what happened. And that's why the staircase is in the Ford Museum today.
Wow.
Because he said that's what happened. For example, until they renovated last month, the Ford's exhibit's first kind of entrance exhibit was the Watergate exhibit right away. Before you got to his lifetime, before you got to his great accomplishments, it was Watergate happened. Richard Nixon appointed him vice president, and then Richard Nixon resigned and he became president. So it's possible to do it. I would argue that maybe he didn't have as much pressure to get it right because he was an unelected president with a short term and with not a lot of funding.
Yeah,
but
I was going to say, so part of it is a reference, it's really a reflection of the character of the person.
Yes. I think my concern isn't with whether or not people want to promote the president. I think if it was a private museum that was funded completely by private donations, people could go to town. My concern is that once it gets built, it gets handed over to the National Archives, and the Archives administration operates it on behalf of the American people. And so then it becomes a governmental museum with governmental resources, and that's where we get into some trouble about whether or not we should be supporting politicized and factually inaccurate exhibits.
So I have some friends that they're making it. They say, I want to see every presidential museum. I'm going to travel around. Does every president have a museum?
No. In fact, the vast majority don't.
That makes their trip easier.
Yes, it does. If you wanted to go to all the presidential libraries that are run by the U.S. government and you did it before 2022 when the Obama Library opened, you'd only have to go to 13.
So only 13 presidents have libraries?
That are run by the federal government. And then there's about a handful of other ones, like the Lincoln Library, which is run by the state of Illinois.
That's true.
There's the Woodrow Wilson Library in Stanton, Virginia, that's run by a private organization. There's the Rutherford B. Hayes. There's a whole bunch of other ones that are out there. And there's recently the George Washington Library opened at Mount Vernon.
So why hasn't the federal government made efforts to take over or otherwise get jurisdiction over those presidential spaces?
Well, what happened was, like, for example, the Woodrow Wilson organization petitioned the government about 10 years ago and asked to be brought into the fold. The concern was that if we went past Herbert Hoover, which is the earliest president who has a federal library, then all the other 30-odd presidents who don't have libraries would then be coming forward, and would we have a Millard Fillmore presidential library? Would we have a James Buchanan presidential library?
But let me stop you. What's wrong with that? Why shouldn't every president have a library, even if you are Millard?
Well, here's one of the problems with – let's say you're a scholar and you want to do a book on American involvement in Southeast Asia. Right now you have to travel to Kansas and Missouri and Michigan and California and, you know, all over the country and Texas and Massachusetts, because all those presidential libraries are scattered. But if you wanted to look at Reconstruction era and how presidents from, you know, Grant on handled it, or even from Johnson – you could go to the Library of Congress, where all those records are, because the vast majority of presidential records from before 1928 are in the Library of Congress. So are we going to break up those that great single source?
Yeah.
And spread it all over the country?
I guess what's cool is, you know, when you go to these presidential, I've been to Carter's, you know, and Johnson's, I've been to several, but you also get so much of their personal life. I mean, a lot of, like, you know, Reagan has the plane. Air Force One is there, which people, I haven't seen that yet, but, you know, I would love to go on there. I mean, it's, if you're fascinated by the life of a president, the fact that there are so many actual artifacts and maybe furniture, and Harry Truman, I remember, well, that was not his library, but I went to Truman's house. I mean, it was left just the way he left it. His coat's hanging by the door, along with his umbrella. Kind of cool when you're into that stuff, like I am.
Absolutely. I would say that the most astonishing, you know, meaningful experience I've had is at the Truman Library. There's a small exhibit with a letter and a medal, and it's when President Truman died, they found it in his desk in the library, and he had kept it all the years since he had been a president. And it was from a man whose son was killed in Korea, and he was sending back the medal that his son had won, and it was an angry letter that blamed the president for the death of his son. And the man even went so far as to say that he wished that Margaret Truman, Truman's daughter, was a son, so that Truman could feel what he felt. Now, Truman kept that letter, which was very damaging, you know, and it was very upsetting, but he kept that letter and that medal in his desk drawer for almost 20 years. And to see that little exhibit and to see the window into that kind of man is wonderful. And I have similar experiences in almost every presidential library until I start thinking about the $100 million a year we spend of taxpayer dollars and whether or not there could be a better use of it. Because I'm all for preserving and making the records available. I think that should be the primary goal, but it really isn't. It isn't even near the primary goal.
Just, I'd like to wrap with this sort of question. Obviously, scholars, researchers, academicians, I get why they're at these libraries. I even get why, you know, people who are just sort of fascinated with a certain president want to go. But in a general sense, why is it important to the American public that a president, the Obama Library is next, this podcast is based out of Chicago, why is it important that the records, the life of President Barack Obama be made available to the public? Research aside, those kind of issues aside, why is it important?
I think that early on it was a sense of instilling and maintaining patriotic values. I mean, being able to go to the FDR Library, which was his home, which was where he worked, like I said, it gave you a sense of pride. I think as the years developed, it became a way to extend the political fights that we had. So, for example, for every person who is angry about Iran-Contra or about the Iraq War and the way it's treated in the George W. Bush Library, they're going to be happy to see the Affordable Care Act, you know, and other issues in the Obama Library there. So I think it's changed from any American can go to any presidential library and feel a sense of pride to Republicans are going to go to Republican libraries and Democrats are going to go to Democratic libraries. Now, there are people who go to the opposite party libraries. I call them they hate visit. You know, they go to see and seethe and say, oh, I can't believe what Obama said. I can't believe what Carter said. I can't believe what Reagan said about XYZ. But for the most part, it's people go primarily to support the president that they supported.
And by the way, are most presidents buried at their libraries? I know, I think future ones tend to be, but and Kennedy is not. But are most of them buried on the grounds?
Yeah, the majority are. I right now, the only president who is only former president who's living who won't be buried at his library is Jimmy Carter. He'll be buried in Plains, at his house.
And we know that because we know that he said that.
Yes, in fact, well, every president works with the Military District of Washington from before they become president to start planning their military, you know, their funeral.
Right.
And so we have those records on file.
Do we know, I mean, just curious, why doesn't Carter, I mean, I think part of honoring the legacy, I think people sort of, you know, finalize that moment by paying respects at the grave of the president. Do we know why Carter wants to, I know he's from Plains, is that why he wants to go back, as opposed to the place that people will go visit?
I don't know officially, but, for example, a lot of people do visit the Johnson Library and then visit the Johnson Ranch and his burial place. I think my guess is that it might help extend the attention that's paid. You know, Plains is about 3 hours south of Atlanta, and there's not a lot of tourists who go there other than for Jimmy Carter. And so maybe it's his way to kind of extend that benefit to the town.
Interesting. And perhaps he'll leave a, you know, a note of legacy about why that decision is, or I imagine that people know that. Well, this is fascinating stuff, and I'm sure anybody listening to this wants to know more about these libraries. The title of the book couldn't be better. I mean, the notion of the last campaign really says it all, because this is we sometimes see these presidential libraries as this objective view of a presidency, and it is anything but that. The book is The Last Campaign, How Presidents Rewrite History, Run for Posterity, and Enshrine Their Legacies. I loved reading this book. I've actually read it quite a while ago, and I just encourage everybody who's listening to learn more about Anthony Clark by reading that book and learn about these libraries. It's fascinating stuff. Anthony, I appreciate your being with me and for sharing all the insight, and wait for your next book.
Thanks, Paul. Great to talk to you. Hope to talk to you again soon.
You got it. Take care.
Take care.
And joining me now is Illinois Secretary of State, long-serving Secretary of State, Jesse White. And Mr. Secretary, thanks for joining my podcast.
Paul, glad to be on board, sir.
Now, you have been Secretary of State. You're in your fifth term. And I just have to, we'll talk about some issues, but as a means of sort of reflection over time, how has this state changed over your years in office as Secretary of State? And, and you can toss in all those years in the legislature as well. You were there for 16 years.
I had the great pleasure of serving in the Illinois General Assembly for a period of 16 years, representing probably the most diverse district in the nation, Lincoln Park to Paul River North, Streeterville, the Gold Coast area to Magnificent Mile and Cabrini Green. And some people would refer to my district as going from the Gold Coast to the Soul Coast. And then I became the Cook County Recorder of Deeds for 6 years, and then Secretary of State for the past 18 years. Professional baseball player in a couple organization for 8 years, and 10 years in the military, used to jump out of perfect good airplanes. And I'm proud of the fact, too, that for 58 years, I've had the great pleasure of being the coach and founder of the Jesse White Tumbling Team.
Yeah, I have a feeling that's one of your points of real pride, are the tumbler. So as you look at that, I mean, your legacy, when you think of your legacy, because this is your last term, you've announced you're not running for reelection. Do you look at those kinds of community things you've done, or do you take a look at the accomplishments professionally, if so to speak, as your lasting legacy, or both?
Well, Paul, I just believe that when you come through this world and you become successful, you give back. I also believe you do something good for someone every day, and that's how I run my life. When you look at what's happening on the south side and the west side of the city of Chicago, where young people are getting themselves into trouble, harming others, I just believe that when we work together to try to give these young people an opportunity to use idle time in a positive way, it's a win-win situation for all of us, and every day I work toward that end.
Let's take a look at, listen, Springfield. I have to ask you about that. I don't think... I'll ask you, have you ever seen it this bad in Springfield in all your years in dealing with legislators?
I've had the great pleasure of serving under about six governors, and this is the first time we've had it so bad. And I just hope that these individuals, the speaker, the president, and the governor will sit down in a smoke-filled room or a smokeless room and arrive at a budget so that the people of the state of Illinois can enjoy the life that they richly need and deserve.
I hope this is a fair question. Some would say the governor is trying to run this like a business. He's a businessman. And others say government is not a business. So the question I have for you is, how is government different from a business in terms of trying to run it and make decisions? You've run sections of the government for so much of your career.
Well, in the business community, you're trying to generate a profit. In the political arena, you're trying to provide services for the people. And that's what... the people in this state richly need to deserve. When you look at all of the programs with parents wanting to go to work, needing child care, senior citizens who are needing the various benefits, and those who are disabled, the list goes on and on as to how these individuals are being affected by the fact that you don't have a budget.
Your budget got impacted because you had to stop sending out notices to people to remind them to get their licenses renewed, stickers on their car. Man, it's just tough stuff. But how's it going? Are you getting complaints? Are people sort of adjusting and looking at the stickers on their car now? What are people doing?
Well, they were a little angry with us because the fact that when they would come into our facility, we would charge them a late fee. And then there are times when law enforcement would catch them. And they would find them. And so because we didn't have a budget, we had to save about $450,000 because we could not afford to send out those notices. And now we rely on individuals to go out and look at the license themselves. Or they could go to our website and put in a request for us to notify them when it's time for them to get their sticker renewed.
If they resolve this budget mess, I mean, you will go back to sending out notices, right? Or are you trying to just get people trained?
Well, I think we're one of the only states that will that has been courteous enough, genuine enough, or involved in the process of notifying individuals. We will go back to that process, but right now, $450,000 a month, that's quite a bit of money, and we don't have it. But once we get it, we're going to make sure that we do what is right for our constituents.
I want to talk about the new driver's licenses because I just got mine renewed and got, you know, it looks nice, it looks secure, but Homeland Security doesn't seem to be happy with the driver's license Illinois is using right now.
Well, we're coming out with a new license. It has all of the bells and whistles, ever devised by man or woman. The process is really designed to cut back on fraud, identity theft. And 9/11 was really what prompted Homeland Security to get involved with this program. Right now, 39 states have the new license. As of the end of July, we will have the new license that will be made available for you. It will allow you to get on an airplane, allow you to get into some of the federal buildings. It will allow you to do a lot of things that you're not able to do right now. When you go into the Secretary of State's office right now, we will put a hold in your license, your old license, and then we'll give you a paper license. And you can use the paper license to get on an airplane. Homeland Security said they'll accept it. And you're good to go. And then 15 days later, you'll get one in the mail. And so it's important for you to make sure that you let the Secretary of State's office know whether you've changed your address or not.
So is this a transition? In other words, if I get my new license, say, next year, will that just be like the old time the Secretary of State, I'm there, I get my new license, and it's fine? Or will this always be a process of having to do this paper check?
Well, you'd always have to do the background check because during the 15-day period of time, we have people in Springfield who will be involved with making sure that you are who you say you are. We're concerned about identity theft. We're concerned about fraud. And then we'll give you probably one of the finest documents ever devised by a man or woman. It has all of the bells and whistles on it that law enforcement need.
So just so I understand, so it won't be the case, even when the system is all set, even a couple of years from now, nobody will no longer go into Secretary of State's office and get their license within minutes. That's not going to happen anymore.
It will not happen again. We used to pride ourselves on giving you a license at the barrelhead, at the wellhead, but now we're like California. We mail it out.
Okay. I want to talk about teen driving for a little bit. My daughter is driving now. I asked you not to give her a license, but you told me that because she passed, you could not give it to her. So, Mr. Secretary, she appreciates that. But anyway, tell me about teen driving. You make such efforts to make sure these kids are safe.
Because of our effort to require parents to spend 50 hours behind the wheel with their child, 10 hours at night, and then there are times, and one unrelated person in the automobile with you for the first 1 year period of time. And there are times when individuals get involved with street racing or drag racing, or if they get a ticket, they used to go to court and represent themselves. Now they bring their parents with them to court. And if by chance you get caught drag racing, street racing, then of course you lose your license, you go to jail, and then there's a 1 year suspension on your license. But we've also done one thing that we're proud of, and that is we have a contract that we have on our website where parents could read the contract, child could read the contract, both affix their signatures to it. So when there's an infraction, then parents won't have any problems getting the license the keys from the child. But there's one other thing. Parents could now go into our website and request the PIN number to us, to your child's system, and so they can find out how well your child is driving or how poorly your child is driving. It's called Gotcha.
Perfect. Let me ask you a bit about organ donations. Very important to you. You've really pushed for that. Just out of curiosity, I know you have some statistics. Do you find younger people, as they get their licenses, do you have more success with younger people than older, or doesn't that matter?
Well, it doesn't matter, but we sign up our young people at age 18. We ask for several things. We want them to sign up for the draft, sign up for the organ donor program, and then we also ask them to sign up to vote because we just believe that if you don't vote, you lose your grant rights. You cannot complain about anything in society. But we're proud of the fact that we have 6 million people who've signed up to become organ donors. 5,000 people in New England as we speak, and each year about 300 people die because organs have not arrived in a timely manner. We ask that when you're alive and well, give blood. When you're no longer here, give organs. When you've done those two things, you made a positive impact upon society, considering the fact that one person can provide life or improve the quality of life for 25 individuals.
Let's turn to national politics for a little bit. You are a Clinton delegate. You'll be in Philadelphia for Secretary Clinton. And have things gone the way you expected to go? Bernie Sanders put up quite the challenge to her, but what's your reflection on, as you look forward, Trump versus Clinton? Interesting race.
Well, let's talk about Sanders. I'm saddened by the fact that he's been in Congress for a long period of time, and some of the initiatives that he wanted to put forth were not dealt with then. And so, as they would say in Jamaica, take it easy, man. But when it comes to Clinton, I'm a delegate. I've been a supporter of the Clinton family for many, many years. I believe that since she was the wife of the governor, she's been the wife of the president, and she's been Secretary of State for this great country of ours. I think she did a great job. I believe that she's well qualified, or best qualified, to run this great country of ours.
Now, you, by the way, you're going as a superdelegate, right?
I'm a superdelegate, yes.
So everybody's, Bernie Sanders complaining about superdelegates. So let me ask you about this. What do you think of the superdelegate system? Some people think like that's what makes the game rigged.
Well, if Bernie had gotten on board early on and had been going from state to state trying to woo some of these superdelegates, maybe he would be in better shape now than he is now.
But do you believe in superdelegates? Are they effective in the system, or would you like to see them go away? Because I'm thinking he might try and push for that as a change.
Well, the superdelegates are the elected officials, and we just think that the elected officials, who are also some of our party leaders, are better equipped to determine who is the best person qualified to run and then go out and support that individual.
Some people would say, but if you do that, what you're saying is the voter shouldn't matter. I saw a cartoon once that said, "You vote, we decide."
Yep. If the voters thought enough to elect you to a political office, then I think the rest speaks for itself.
She faces Donald Trump. I know you're not a Trump supporter by any means, but let's be honest. We could wake up to a President Trump on November 8th. It is possible in this country.
It would be a sad day for me personally. It would be a sad day for the people of this wonderful country of ours.
So tell me why it is you believe people should vote for Hillary Clinton as president, aside from she's got the credentials, but you know her. Tell me about her.
Well, first of all, I think that if you don't vote, you lose your gripe rights. You cannot complain about anything in society. And when it comes to Hillary Clinton, I think she's best qualified to be the president of the United States. And I think that Donald Trump would be a big embarrassment for us.
Mr. Secretary, you're, as I said at the beginning, you're in your final term as Secretary of State. You announced, actually on my show early on, before other people think they got the scoop, I got the scoop, which was that you said you would not run for another term. So let's use this as just a legacy moment. As you look back on your term, what are you most proud of, both in terms of Secretary of State, but as I said, but in your career?
Well, I had the great pleasure of serving 16 years in the Illinois General Assembly, and I represent the most diverse district in the nation, Lincoln Park, DePaul, River North, Streeterville, the Gold Coast area, and Cabrini Green. And then I had the great pleasure of running the second largest Court of Deeds office in the nation for 6 years. And now I run the largest Secretary of State office and held this position for the past 18 years. And then I played 8 years professional baseball in the Cub organization, and I like the Cubs, Cardinals, and White Sox, not necessarily in that order. And then I served in the military not once, not twice, but three times. I was a paratrooper, guardsman, and reservist, 15 years as a teacher, and 33 years as a teacher, and 58 years as coach and founder of the Jesse White Tumbling Team. And everything that I've ever done in life, I've enjoyed. And so it's kind of hard for me to pick and choose what position and what job I've enjoyed the most. But when it comes to government, Secretary of State's office is the best office of government.
All right, sir, I know you said you wanted to tumble for our audience, but unfortunately this is sort of a radio vehicle, not visual, so we'll just let everybody know that I'm going to watch you tumble around the studio.
Paul, it's always better to be a tumbler rather than a stumbler.
I love it. My guest, Secretary of State Jesse White. Sir, I'm going to thank you now for your service, even though I know we'll be talking to you again, but thank you. We can do it publicly right here. Thank you.
Let's do it, Paul. Thank you.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website,
paullisnick.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes and tune in each week to hear more insider scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.